There's a request of learning today should be as an Ili Neshama for Sarah Bas Yisrael Leib and Penina Bas Sarah. So this learning should be, his Yortzeit are this week. So Ili Neshama for those two women. So back to the Haggadah, we've been going through, I guess we'll call them Haggadah tidbits, and little pieces about the Haggadah here and there, messages and lessons and stories. So I want to pick up this week, I guess if, you know, I can say a page number for you. If most people have this Haggadah, I can find the page.
So,
in the Maxwell House Haggadah, I'm going to be speaking first about page 12. Or 13, in Maxwell Sagada, which is the paragraph, Mitchilo of the Avarazar Hayavasenu. So, last time we left off discussing the concept of Maschel Bagnosim Messiah Bishvach, you begin speaking about the negative, you begin speaking about the disgrace of the Jews, the fact that we were serving idols and that we were slaves, and you move into the positive, into the freedom in serving Hashem. So, this paragraph, it discusses. The passage from Yeshua, it says, I'll just read the English to make it easy. And Joshua said to all the people, so says the Eternal, the God of Israel, your ancestors, Terach, the father of Abraham, the paragraph begins with In, and the father of Nahor lived on the other side of the river, and they served other gods. So that's our origins were from idolaters. But I took your father Abraham to the other side of the river, and led him through all the land of Canaan, and multiplied his seed, and gave him Isaac, and I gave Jacob and Esav to Yitzchak, and I gave Esav Mount Seir to be in his possession, but Jacob's children went down to Egypt. So this is really the origins of Klal Yisrael. We came from idolaters. Abraham decided to get up and change his way of life. He discovered Hashem, discovered monotheism. He built up Emunah, and from Yitzchak and Yaakov, you know, we became a people. But this led us into Mitzrayim, down to slavery in Egypt. So what it alludes to here is the promise to Abraham. It says, "V'arbe zaro, I will multiply his seed." I mean, Abraham is promised to have many, many children. And the full version of that promise we find in the Torah. It says, "Harbe arbe zaracha kochei shemayim, I will increase your children like the stars of the sky, v'kachol sharas fas hayom, and like the sand of the sea." So much has been said about these two different analogies. When we talk about the increase of the children of Abraham, the Jews are compared to the stars of the sky and the sand in the sea. And what are these analogies exactly? Because this is the future of Klal Yisrael, our destiny. This is who we are. So that's the allusion over here in this paragraph. So again, I'm mostly quoting this year from this Haggadah Umasoka Or from Rav Shlomo Levenstein, and I'm going to continue that this week. I've done the past 2 weeks as well. He says the following point, but I'll preface with another point. The two analogies are the stars and the sand. So one very famous concept about the analogy to the stars. What exactly is the lesson comparing the Jews to stars? So you can say that we're very bright, we shine, there's lots of them. I mean, there's a lot of different analogies to stars. But one very potent analogy is that every single star we see, we don't realize the power of that star. You know, the sun, we know, the sun is closer to Earth. The sun gives us light, gives us warmth, provides life for us. And the blazing heat of the sun is beyond that which we can imagine. And the sun, astronomers say, is a small star. It's, you know, as stars go, the sun is not a large star. It's a smaller star. And for us, it's life. For us, it's everything. But that's all it is. The stars that we see out there, you know, they're tremendously powerful. There's so much light. It's just that, you know, because they're so distant, it's concealed. Every single Jew contains that much light. When we compare the Jews to the stars of the sky, we're saying that every single Jew has within himself or herself the unlimited power, unlimited light to bring to the world, just like a star. So there's a very powerful analogy to the stars beyond the numerous and how many stars there are, which there are a huge amount of stars, astronomers say. You know, we only see a very few of them, especially in our lighted cities. But there are billions and billions of stars out there. But beyond that, just every single star contains within it energy which could, you know, sustain the world, energy which can burn up anything in its path. That's how powerful a star is. That's how powerful every single Jew is. Every single Jew has that potential within to give off that light and that heat and that warmth to the world. So that's one analogy to the stars of the sky. Now there's another analogy to the sand beach, you know, on the edge of the ocean. So what's that analogy? And again, much has been said about this. He quotes here from the Malbim, one of the famous commentators in the Torah. The Malbim says the following point. What's the analogy to the sand of the ocean shore? He says that we find very often in Tehillim and other places in Tanakh that we refer to the beach, to the sand, as a border to the ocean. Meaning essentially the amount of water in the ocean could totally cover the earth. But yet Hashem made it that the ocean is contained within its boundaries, within its sand. The sand is kechol shesvas hayam, is gvul, samti chol gvul layam, it says. That I've made the sand a border to the ocean. And you find that, again, several times in Tanakh, we make that reference. So how is that analogy pertinent to the Jewish people? So the Malbim says that just like the sand creates a barrier so the ocean does not come and inundate the world, he says so too. There's many nations in the world that try to destroy the Jews, but there's a barrier, and they'll never fully accomplish that. As many times as happened in history, the nations have come to try to destroy us, to eliminate us, starting from Paro and moving on to this very day. Hashem will not let that happen. We stand as the sand to the ocean, and so sometimes a wave might make it in a little bit, but a wave, the ocean will never totally flood the world. Because that's how Hashem constructed the world, based on the sand, based on the shores, based on the beach. So that's the analogy given. He expands this analogy further. You know, you can look out on the ocean on a normal day, and there's some tremendous waves out there. Forgetting hurricanes and tsunamis and the like, just there could be waves that are 10, 20, 30, 40 feet tall, even on a normal, depending on where you go on a normal day. And those waves could come had they reached the shore and flowed over. They could overtake cities. As we see, unfortunately, occasionally with a tsunami, a humongous wave can come and it can totally flood a city in a terrible way. But that doesn't happen usually because those waves are held back by the ocean, by the beach, by the sand. So too, Hashem promises Avraham, your children will be numerous like the sand of the sea, meaning that your children will be inundated with these waves. There will be nations that come to destroy us, but don't worry, you're going to remain strong, and there's going to be this fortress, this barrier holding back those waves so they don't destroy you. The first one was Paro came along, Hashem held Paro back. Along came, he gives examples, Nebuchadnezzar, or Haman, or Titus, and all the different people who destroyed the land of Israel, they came along, we held them back. You move further in throughout our exile, we've had many, many other rulers and nations to come destroy us, we've held them back. He quotes here a famous story from the Panovitcher Rav, of Yosef Kahaneman, who was the Rav in the city of Panovich prior to World War II. He left before the Nazis invaded, and he actually survived. I think his family was killed up. He survived and built up yeshiva in Israel, the Panovich yeshiva in Bnei Brak. But there's a famous story about the Panovitcher Rav. I mean, you've heard it before. One time he was traveling, and he stopped in Italy on his travels. He was there to collect money for the yeshiva. And you know, he was very, very rushed. You know, he was there on business. He was running around place to place. And he had to get back to move to his next stop. But he asked his driver, please bring me to the Arch of Titus. The Arch of Titus is an arch that remains from the times of Titus, the emperor. And he was the one who destroyed the Second Temple. And there's an arch there to commemorate, you know, that conquest, to commemorate Titus. So the Panovitcher Rav said, please take me to see that arch. I want to see the arch. So even though his schedule was very, very tight, and this is his last day there, that he can go and collect more money before he went back to Israel. It's very important for him to go see the Arch of Titus. So they brought him there. So Rav Kahaneman got out of the car, and he stood there, and he looked at the Arch of Titus, and he went back to the car. So they asked him, why was this important to you? You were only there for like a minute. Like, what did you do there? Why did you have to see this? Why takes this precedence? So he explained, I stood there, and I said the following. I said, Titus, you destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. You spilled out rivers of blood of Jews. But where are you today? Nothing's left of you besides this arch. But Am Yisrael, the Jewish people, are alive and well, continuing on in Torah, in mitzvos, and serving Hashem. And he wanted to go and express that emotion at the Arch of Titus. So this is very much a part of what Hashem promised Abraham, that your people, your children are going to continue on eternally. You'll have your challenges, you'll have your times people try to destroy you, but no, they're all gone, and we're still here. So that's really the message of the sand. The sand stands as a barrier that we can't be destroyed. And there are many times you find that the other nations who come to destroy us are compared to waves. That's actually a common mashal, it's a common analogy given. So with that, we are the sand, they're the waves, and as powerful as a wave is, ultimately the sand stops the waves. this very much works in tandem with the next part of the God I want to discuss, Vehisha Amda. That's on the bottom of the page here, bottom of page 13. The famous Vehisha Amda, we'll read the translation, and is that it's the very last paragraph on 13, and is that promise which has been our ancestors' support and ours. For not just one has stood against us, but in every generation some have arisen to exterminate us. Yet the Most Holy One and Blessed always saved us. So Vehisha Amda, we are expressing that emotion that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is always there to save us. As many times in history as we've been put to the challenge, and nations have risen up against us, we remain, and as Rav Kahneman pointed out, they're gone, and we're still here. So Vehisha Amda really is that expression of this exact emotion. Just to comment for a second on Vehisha Amda, there's actually a discussion. The word Vehisha Amda, it's a vague word, Vehid, and this is what stood for us. So this translation says it is the promise to Avram that stood for us, which is one way to interpret it. But there's many ways to understand what exactly is this Vehi. What does it mean, this has stood for us? So again, the simple meaning is, as we're saying, the Vehi is the promise to Abraham. Hashem promised Abraham, you will be an eternal nation, and therefore nobody can destroy us. He quotes here from the great Rav Sanzer Rav, Rav Chaim Sanzer. He was once, unfortunately, beaten up by a non-Jew. And he said to this non-Jew, he expressed himself, and he said, you should know that I don't know if I'm going to remain alive, but I guarantee that the Jews remain alive. And that's always our feeling, that, you know, as individuals, you know, Hashem should always save us. As a people, we'll never be destroyed. There's another reference, I guess more of a vague reference, or more of a slight allusion, that the he could also refer to the cup of wine. Now we lift up at this point the cup of wine at the Seder, the he shamda. And there's again, I know this is not the simple meaning, but you could interpret it to mean that it's this cup of wine that has stood for us in all these generations to save us. Now what would that mean exactly? Why is the cup of wine so significant? So we know that the cup of wine carries within a lot of significance. And let's explain this for a second. The rabbis teach us that the Jews in Mitzrayim, when we were slaves, we had very little going for us spiritually. We had sunken into the depths of a avodah zarah, of idolatry. We were almost culturally the same as the Egyptians. No, we had lost our identity as Jews for the most part. The Rambam says that we were slaves in Egypt. He says we almost lost everything that Abraham and the Avos had done for us. We'd almost lost it. That's how far we had sunken. But Chazal tell us that we did have some merit, which is that we maintained our Jewish names, our language, and our dress. Meaning, despite the fact that we may have acted like Egyptians within ourselves, we didn't associate with them. We didn't assimilate into Egyptian culture. So we took on their ways. We took on their practices. We even may have taken on idolatry. But a Jew is still distinguishable in that he was wearing, you know, his Jewish mode of clothing. They were speaking their language, I guess Hebrew, and they had Jewish names. So they still remain separate from the Goyim in that manner. So somewhat on the following point, that why at the Seder, we mentioned I think last week or 2 weeks ago, we have a mitzvah to have 4 cups of wine at the Seder. So we discussed how the 4 cups of wine represent the 4 terms of redemption. Hashem says, I will save you, I'll take you out, I'll save you, I'll redeem you, I'll take you as my nation. So 4 cups of wine, 4 terms of redemption. We mentioned a couple weeks ago, why wine? And we gave one answer then. But there's another answer given as to why is wine the chosen way to recognize these 4 terms of redemption? I mean, you could have had 4 apples, 4 matzo balls, you know, 4 chicken legs, like you could have done a lot of things. Why did we choose 4 cups of wine? So one concept of wine is that, and I've never tried this out, but they say that a grapevine can't be grafted. It's always going to be a pure grapevine. Many other fruits could be grafted. You can make nectarines, and you can make plum cots, and you can make all these different, you know, blends of fruits, and it works. But there's a concept that's quoted in the Gemara that pregeven inu makabel harkava. You can't graft grapes. So which means that a grape remains separate. You know, the grape always remains a grape, and you can never mix it with anything else. So it's symbolic of the fact of assimilation. A grape can't assimilate into other cultures. A grape remains a grape, and a grape's always going to remain that way. So when you drink these 4 cups of wine, the wine is a symbol. Why did we deserve to be saved? Because despite the fact we were doing bad things, we still remained distinct as Jews. We didn't totally assimilate. We kept our identity. just like the grape kept its identity and it can't be blended into anything else. So when you say v'hi she'amda, you pick up the cup and you say, this cup of wine represents the reason why we remained Jews, why we were saved, because it keeps us distinct. That's part of v'hi she'amda. Furthermore, we know that when it comes to wine and grape products, the rabbis are very strict about what we can drink and what we can't drink. The Torah talks about, there's a halacha called Yain Nesach. The Goyim used to use wine, offer it as a sacrifice to idols, so therefore we can't drink their wine that was idolatrous wine. But the rabbis extended that and said that any wine from a Goy, you can't drink. And that's the halacha, that's why we have to have kosher wine. Even though it's just essentially juice of the grape, we need kosher wine because the rabbis made a decree, you can't drink wine from a Goy. Why is that? They're concerned for assimilation, intermarriage, that was their concern. You know, so you sit down and drink with somebody, it creates this closeness, you might get too close, therefore you might want to marry into their family. And that was the decree of called Stam Yenam, of not drinking wine from non-Jews, even if it's not a concern of idolatry. But that's part of the concept here as well. We say that V'hi She'amda, that we remain Jews because we didn't assimilate. So not only does wine represent this because the grape can't be grafted, but also because wine itself is our symbol of staying separate. That's how we stay separate from Goyim. That's the symbol of us remaining, you know, even though we interact with them in a very, very pleasant way, we have to remain Jews and not assimilate into their culture. He quotes actually a story from Rav Chanuch Teller, which I guess is in one of his books. Rav Chanuch Teller would tell the following story, which happened during World War I. So there was a Jewish soldier who was fighting for the German army, which in World War I was commonplace, despite what happened in World War II. And he was involved for, it was 3 years of a very, very bloody war, very difficult war. And there was a Jewish soldier who was going out to fight. So they made this big campaign, and you know they fought a big battle, and this troop of the German army was successful, they won that battle. And they were so excited about this win, and that was this Jewish soldier was very involved in this battle. He was one of the commanders, and I guess it was his troop that really pulled it through. So they decided to make a special party to honor this Jewish soldier. So this Jewish soldier had a backstory before this party. This Jewish soldier was not religious. He was a secular Jewish soldier. And before he went out to fight in the war, he went to his rabbi. And he said, "Rabbi, I need a blessing." He said, "I'm going out to war. I'm not religious." You know, he was not an observant person. But he said, I need a blessing from the rabbi before I go out to war. So the rabbi told him, "I want you to accept upon yourself one mitzvah. Choose one mitzvah, accept upon yourself, and that will serve to protect you at the war." So this Jewish soldier, he couldn't figure out what to accept. He said that, "Well, I don't want to take on davening, because I don't think I could do that at war. Putting on tefillin, I don't think it's going to work." And he went through a list of mitzvos, and he wasn't able to commit to any of them. So finally, they're speaking about kosher wine. So at least accept on yourself not to drink non-kosher wine. He said, "Okay, I could do that." So everything else, he didn't keep Shabbos, and he didn't daven, didn't put on tefillin, didn't eat kosher. But kosher wine, he accepted. He said, "That rabbi, I'll do that," and the rabbi gave him his blessing. So fast forward again, so he's fighting a war, very difficult battles. Finally, he and his troop are successful. They have this great victory, and they want to honor him at a party. So all the German soldiers get together at the party, and of course they break out the bottles of wine to celebrate. So this Jew now is put in a very hard situation. On the one hand, you know, they're honoring him. If he says, "I can't drink the wine," they're going to be quite upset. I mean, despite the fact it's World War I, these are still German soldiers. On the other hand, you know, he committed to the rabbi that I'm not going to drink non-kosher wine. So what does he do? So he said, "You know, I can't break my promise to the rabbi. I have to figure out something." So as he's standing there with a cup of wine in his hands, the soldiers all heard this racket out from outside. There was this noise, and they saw that there were some fighter planes coming close to the building where they're having this party. So he ran to the window to see. Everyone ran to the window to see what's happening. And at the window, this Jew, he poured his wine out the window. So he thought, "Okay, I figured it out. I poured wine out the window, and therefore I want to drink the wine." But unfortunately, two of the officers saw him do this. And they went and they told the commanding officer. And he was very insulted by this. He was very upset about it. And because he was so angry, he said, "I'm sending you back out to the front lines. I can't have you here." He sent him out. So this Jew was very upset now. And he was not an observant Jew. he had promised the rabbi he's going to do this, and this got him back into harm's way. He thought that he had succeeded, they were honoring him, and then he's sent back out to the war again. But what was he supposed to do? So he packed his bags, and he went back, back on the train out to the battlefront. So, and he was very angry, very upset. When he got to the next station on the train, he was informed that there was an attack of enemy planes upon that previous troop you were in, and everybody was killed. And he was saved. That's the story. So, Rabbi Teller tells the story. So it could be, I don't have any further source. But it's from Rabbi Teller, yeah. Rabbi Teller's story. But this story is a story how the fact that he remained separate from the Goyim saved him. So that's not our goal necessarily. But our goal is to always appreciate that we have to interact appropriately with others, but we have to remain Jews, we have to remain distinct as Jews, and we can never compromise on our principles in order to assimilate with others. That's part of the idea of Hisha Amda. And that's the kind, and the Seder, part of the Seder is actually accomplishing a little bit of this Jewish pride, that we're proud of who we are, we stand by our principles, and if that's what kept us safe in Mitzrayim, that'll keep us safe forever. That's part of our goal. So that's an important point about Hisha Amda. I want to move ahead a little bit in the Haggadah. Find the right page here. So the Haggadah starts to tell the story of the slavery, and it says on page 15 now. So it talks about the story of the slavery, and then it says, once the Jews are mistreated, they started to daven to Hashem. They prayed, and they requested that Hashem save them. So I'm on the second to last paragraph on page 15, and we cried out to the Eternal, the God of our fathers, and the Eternal heard our voice, saw our affliction, our sorrow, and our oppression. So Torah tells us that a major part of our salvation was tefillah, was prayer. And we don't always recognize that. We picture the point that Hashem came in to save us because we were in so much pain. But there's a very important part of that in the Torah, which is that we prayed. We daven to Hashem, please save us. We're suffering, we're being tormented, we're tortured, we're in anguish. And then Hashem listened to our tefillos and saved us. That's what the Torah tells us here. That's not God to teach us over here. We have to know that tefillah is a very essential part of the Pesach story. So I want to share with you two very powerful points made by the Netziv. Rav Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, the great commentator on the Torah, and he speaks about what were the tefillos that were said by the Jews in Mitzrayim, how they daven, and what's the context of this davening. So this is found in the Torah. It's in the book of Shmos, in the second parak, chapter 2. And it says that in those days, v'yamas mach Mitzrayim, the Paro had died. So there was a Paro that died, and a new Paro arose. So it says the Paro had died, and the Jews, they called out because of their hard work, v'yizaku, and they cried out, and their prayers went up to Hashem because of their work. So the Netziv says, well, what's the connection between this first Paro dying and the Jews davening? I mean, maybe they should have davened before also, you'd think. And why is it that they're only davening right now? So one commentary, the Ramban, says, well, they daven now because they hope when Paro number one died, Paro two would be better. Maybe kinder, more benevolent, more compassionate. But when they saw that the next Paro also was no good, then that's when they started davening. They lost hope because they had hope that a second Paro would arise who was better, and he wasn't. That's one way to understand it. The Netziv says a very important point here, very relevant to us. The Netziv says the reason that the Torah records that they davened only once Paro died is because when Paro died, as is common in any sort of royal setting, there was a day given off to mourn Paro, the loss of Paro. Basically, the country had a day of mourning. So they were off work that day. These slaves rarely got off work. But the day Paro died, they got the day off work because the king had died and everyone took off to gather to show their respects. So once they had a day off of work, now they're able to actually take some time to think about life, and that brought them to tefillah. And very often when we're involved in the daily grind, and we have no time to ourselves, no time to breathe, no time to think, so we don't even gather together enough emotional stability to daven. We haven't thought through enough about our life to recognize we need to daven, because we haven't had time to contemplate, we haven't had time to think. Often when you take a little time to think, at that point, that's when you realize, oh, I better do something. I better change. I better daven. I better take a new step in life. But when you're so involved in the daily grind, and you have no time to yourself, and it's all about all day long, they're working, they come home, they're exhausted, they fall asleep at night, and that's it. they didn't have any time to think about life and think about themselves. Once they had this day off, so now they had time to think about where they were in life, where they should be going. And at that point, they felt how hopeless they were, and they davened to Hashem. It's a very important lesson for us. The Masil Susharim, he says that one of the greatest tactics of the Yetzer Hara to get us to do the wrong thing is by keeping us busy. Because when you're so busy, you can't think. So usually when we sit down and think about life, we come to some form of clarity, and then we try to make a path for ourselves to change. But when we're so busy, and there's no time to think about life, so then we don't think about changing either. See, Yetzer Hara says, let's keep them busy. Let's keep them busy every single day, day in and day out, and now they're not going to think, and they're not going to do tshuva. But as soon as you get some time to think about life, and to contemplate, and to focus, at that point it leads you to tshuva. So, and that's actually, the source he brings is also from Paro. It says that when Moshe first came to Paro, and he said to Paro, let people go, free the Jews. So Paro said, you guys must be taking off work. You must be relaxing. Who gave you? Why are you even thinking about this? You're not busy enough. And he gave them more work to do. Because he recognized that as soon as slaves have some time to think for themselves, they're going to start requesting freedom. So he said, I better double your workload so that you don't even have time to think about these things anymore. And he made them go collect their own straw to make the bricks at the end of Parshas Shmos. But that's so the Tziv says that the reason that there's a connection to the death of Paro and the prayers of Klal Yisrael is because they had to have that time to contemplate life before they came out in Tefillah. So that time to think, it's a very important thing. It then says, Vayizaku, they called out. So the Tziv says that they gathered together in one place and they davened as one unified group. So this wasn't just individuals who were in anguish calling out to Hashem as individuals. It says they gathered together and davened. And that also highlights for us the power of tefillah b'tzibur, davening together. When you have the power of all the Jews together uniting in one unit davening, it's much more powerful than individuals davening. That's the concept of davening in a minyan. That's the concept the Gemara tells us that when it comes to, let's say, a day of fasting, Yom Kippur, when days when Klal Yisrael is in need, you have to include in the tefillos, in the fast, even the sinners. Even those who usually you would not want in shul should be invited in for Yom Kippur, should be invited in for times of distress. Because there's times when you all the Jews to come together to pray, and that gives so much more power to the tefillos, that unity, the expression as one to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So Tziv says, in Mitzrayim, they got together and they davened as one, and that added to the power of their tefillos. He makes one other very important point. It says, Batal Shavasam El Elokim Min HaVoda. Literally, that their shouts went up to Hashem from their work. So from their work, we think means because they worked so hard, that created their anguish, and that created their distress, that's why they shouted. But then Tziv says a very important point as well. He says that these were slaves. They were not well versed in the pathways of tefillah. We know nowadays we have a siddur, we pick it up, we have Tehillim, we have the set text of Shemoneh Esrei and of davening, and we know those tefillos are very eloquent. We know they're powerful. We know they're composed with the greatest intentions in mind by the greatest of people who walked on this planet in history, and therefore those words are powerful. When you're a slave in Mitzrayim for 200 years, and you've never had the time to sit and think about spirituality, about God, they didn't have the benefit of having teachers of Torah, teachers of this wisdom, so how do they pray exactly? What do they say? What do they do? And then Tziv says, well, they just called out to Hashem in very simple terms. From the depth of their heart. And the tefillah was just Bekol Tzaka, Oy Vavoy Hashem Elokei Avoseinu, Oy Vavoy Hashem, what are we supposed to do? Very, very simple, very, very earnest, very sincere tefillah. And Hashem listened to that. But that's exactly what it says, Oy Vavoy Hashem Elokei Avoseinu, Oy Vavoy Hashem. But that was their prayer. So they didn't pick up Tehillim and start reciting, Aleph to Kuf Nun, and they didn't pick up their Siddur. They didn't have any education in what tefillah is supposed to be, but it was that heartfelt prayer which reached HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that's a lesson for us. We have the benefit of the Siddur and Tehillim, and we have the benefit of our hearts. And both types of tefillah are very, very significant. We know that the tefillahs which are in our Siddur were written, like as I said, by tremendous people on very high spiritual levels, and those words pack a punch no matter how you say them. If you say those words, whether you understand them or not, whether you feel them or not, those words pack a punch. Those words are powerful. Those words make it to Shemayim. But sometimes we have to say our own heartfelt prayers, our own words. And those also pack a punch when there's sincerity involved. There's a very famous idea from the Briska Rav, I believe, who says that we know that in that Yaakov Avinu says a line, I captured the city of Shechem, the Charbi uvekashti, with my sword and with my bow. So it sounds like Yaakov conquered Shechem, you know, by means of a battle. The Targum Onkelos, he interprets those words, betzlosi v'usi, with my prayers and my supplications. So Targum Onkelos says, the Yaakov said, I didn't capture the city of Shechem through bows and arrows and swords. I captured it by means of prayer. So the Briska Rav said, why are we comparing a prayer to a sword and to a bow? It's a funny comparison. One's a very physical weapon, and one's a very spiritual weapon. But why are you comparing the two? So he said there's two types of prayers. One kind of prayer is compared to a sword, and one kind is prepared to a bow. What's the difference? A bow and arrow. So the arrows are not that sharp on their own right. The power of the arrow is how much force is in that bow. The stronger you pull the bow and it shoots out, then it penetrates. But if you just threw the arrow at somebody, it would just bounce off them and fall on the floor. It wouldn't do anything. A sword is sharp on its own right. And you could touch a short sword to someone very lightly, it'll still cut because it's sharp. So he says that the prayers that we have in the Siddur, those prayers are sharp. And whether or not we have kavana, whether or not we're sincere, whether or not we're focused, it's like a sword, and they will cut through. And those reach Hashem, and those have power. So the more kavana, the better. If you take the sword and you push it, you know, with a lot of strength, it cuts even better. But a sword, even with very, very little force, will cut. The prayers are saying our own. When we make our own heartfelt requests to Hashem, which we should do, that's like a bow and arrow. So if I just throw out words with no kavana, no sincerity, no emotion, and it's my own words, it's like tossing an arrow at somebody with my hand. It'll just bounce off them and fall on the ground. It doesn't go anywhere. If I have kavana, though, if I say my own heartfelt words, and I have kavana when I'm saying, I have real depth of sincerity, and I shoot that tefillah out, so then it penetrates, because that's coming from me. So both are necessary. We have to have our daily tefillos, which are the words given to us in the Siddur, in the text that we have, because those words are powerful in their own right. That's the chair, that's the sword. But we also have to have times where we say our own heartfelt prayers from the heart in our own words. That's the bow. But the sword does not will work without kavana, and the bow requires kavana. And that's his point. So the Jews in Mitzrayim, there was this emotion. I mean, they were slaves, they were tormented, they were downtrodden, they were humbled. And when they called out to Hashem, it was with tremendous sincerity. So their tefillos were like a bow. Their tefillos were not eloquent. They were not using these spiritually charged words of the sages. They didn't know any Kabbalistic intentions to say in their words. They were just calling out from the heart, Oy vavoy Hashem, what can we do? But those are powerful because they were sincere and they were real, like that bow. So we have to daven in that manner. We also have to daven in the manner out of the Siddur, which means that we have our times where we need to take the Siddur, and we have to say the words that Chazal gave us, the words of Tehillim of David HaMelech, and those words are powerful in their own right. And even times where we don't have Kavanah and we're not so emotional, we're not so sincere about it, saying those words has meaning. And those words are powerful. So that's the Netziv's point as to how they daven in Mitzrayim. So the Jews in Mitzrayim, the tefillah was really the catalyst to change the story. The way the Torah portrays it, they were suffering, they davened, Hashem heard, and then he went to Moshe and said, Moshe, go save the Jews. But it was those tefillahs that made the difference. So that's a very powerful point of the Seder. And at the Seder, as we bring out the lessons, that is one topic I think worth discussing, the power of tefillah. Even though it seems to be somewhat of a side point in the Haggadah, but in the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim, it's actually a major turning point. And if we want to strengthen ourselves and make a very powerful discussion of the Seder, I think discussing tefillah is a very appropriate discussion. The power of tefillah, how to daven, when to daven, etc. It's a very important thing. Maybe we'll just, one more point over here. Just skip ahead. This is going to be on page 25, 26. Let's see that page over here. And you can discuss the Haggadah the entire year through. There's so much to say, but you know, our time is limited. So I just want to share one comment on at the very end of Magid. So Magid is where you tell the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim. Magid ends with the beginning of Hallel, and the final step of Magid is a bracha, the bracha of Asher Ge'alanu, the bracha which is proclaiming Hashem as the one who redeemed us. So this bracha, there's a lot in this bracha to be discussed, but I just want to discuss some two words here. The bracha says, let's read the English side. I'm just going to skip down. It says, may you bring us to enjoy in peace other feasts and sacred seasons, which move towards us, that we may be glad in the building of your city and rejoice in your holy service, that we may eat there of the sacrifices and of the holy paschal offerings, etc. So Maggid ends with this tefillah to Hashem. We say, Hashem, you saved us from Mitzrayim, and now may you merit to bring us to enjoy other festivals, other holidays, and bring us back to Yerushalayim, to Eretz Yisrael, that we can rejoice in your service and bring karbanos as we're supposed to. That's this final bracha over here at the end of Maggid. So one thing we daven for is that we should be smechim v'nirecha, we should have joy in the building of your city, the sasen b'avodasecha, and we should rejoice in your service. So there's a tefillah that we're requesting, Hashem, give us joy in your service. So he says here that simcha, having joy in serving Hashem and doing mitzvos, that brings us to consistency. The fascinating thing, we want to be consistent as Jews. So one reason we're not consistent is because if we're not happy with what we're doing, then we fall off. It's hard to be consistent in something. If we have great joy in doing mitzvos, so then we can remain consistent. What's the source for this? So he says that in the bracha of Kiddush Levana, we say every single month on the new moon. So the one of the lines there, it says, Chokuzman nasan lehem, Hashem gave a set time for the stars and for the moon. Shalishan is tafkidam, that they should not change their service. I mean, they should be consistent. Sustim esmecham asur tzun konam, and the heavenly bodies, the stars and the moon, are they rejoice and are happy to do the service of Hashem. So he quotes here from someone, I don't know who this is, Rav Mordechai Heller, who said, how do you know that the moon and stars are happy with what they're doing? Did anybody ask them? What does that mean? It says the moon and the stars are smechim lasos zonkanam. They're happy to do the will of Hashem. Where did that come from? So he says it's very simple. If a person is not happy with what they're doing, so you find excuses to avoid it. I have a headache, I'm tired today, I have something else I have to do. If you don't like what you're doing, so you try to dodge around it. So you do it sometimes. Other times you come up with an excuse. If you see something consistent, that means that they have a joy in what they're doing. And we say the word, the joy we're talking about, it may not be that they're dancing around and smiling all the time. It means there's a certain inner content in that what I'm doing fulfills me, what I'm doing is meaningful, and therefore you stay consistent with it. If you don't like it, so then you find your excuses. So too in serving Hashem. One of the questions we have to ask ourselves is, well, are we consistent? And if we're inconsistent in certain areas, often the answer is because we're not happy about doing them. And often if we work on the joy of being a Jew and the joy of doing a mitzvah, that makes us more consistent. So one of the great requests at the very end of Maggid is we've just been through this entire experience of understanding and feeling the story of Leaving Mitzrayim. And one of the feelings we should walk away with, the emotions should be, I'm so happy to be a Jew. I have such a privilege. I'm Hashem's chosen people. Hashem gave me the Torah. Hashem gave me the benefit of freedom. Hashem gave me the benefit of being royalty. And I'm so proud of who I am. And that brings the joy. And if we can daven at the end of Maggid, the sasim of Hashem, I daven that I should always have joy in doing your mitzvos. It's a very powerful thing. Because when you finish the Haggadah, you should walk away emotionally changed. You should walk away with a little deeper emunah, deeper faith in Hashem, a little more joy in serving Hashem, a little more pride of being a Jew, a little more bitachon in our daily lives. But you should walk away as a changed person, because the Seder is an experience. It's not just a ritual, not just a recitation, it's an experience. If you walk away that way, so then you can say, v'sasin b'avodasecha, Hashem, we will rejoice in your service, because I've become changed based on my Seder. So next week we'll take off, so we can all be ready for the Seder. And I wish everyone a chakashar v'sameach. See everybody after Pesach.